Ray.
Abby, you should never point a gun at anyone unless you mean to shoot him. And if you shoot him, you better make sure he's dead. Because if he ain't dead, he's gonna get up and try and kill you. That's the only thing they taught us in the service is worth a goddamn. Else my windbreaker.
Hello and welcome. Welcome and hello. This is Wait, You Haven't Seen? It's a show where we talk about movies and specifically talk about a movie at least one of us has never seen before. I'm your host Travis, aka TV's Travis. This is episode number 262. Our movie this week, 1984's Blood Simple, and joining me to talk about it, he'd seen it and he wanted to make sure that I had, it is Josh Monroe. Josh, how you doing, man?
Hey, pretty good. Well, it was similar to our last podcast together, 3 Days of the Condor. This was a movie I had not seen, but had been aware of for a long time. And then I finally watched it and was like, oh, we got to talk about this.
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. All right, so... Real quick, give me your history with Blood Simple.
So I had heard of it. I think it was more when I went through film school. It was 2002, 2003. Coen Brothers had been around. Lebowski was a thing, or you know. So the Coen Brothers were kind of well established at that point. So Blood Simple was always one of those. Hey, this was their first movie. You should check it out. Like their origins, their roots, and stuff. But I never actually sought it out. And then in the last like 6 months, I've been kind of going back to some of those things I've always meant to watch and, you know, give them the proper viewing that they really deserve. So that's how I also was getting this conflated and confused with Danny Boyle's first movie, Shallow Grave. So like when somebody would mention one, I would think of the other, which I had not seen either. I've seen both of them now, but, yeah, there was nothing that like specifically drew me to this. Criterion just put out a new release of it, so I think that just like boosted it into the social consciousness or whatever. So it just finally got around to watching it, and yeah, basically that's all it was.
Gotcha. Yeah, kind of similar for me. Like I always knew it was around, and I'm a Coen Brothers fan of everything of theirs that I've watched so far.
Yeah, and I have still yet to see Miller's Crossing, which I know is great, but I have not seen it. It's like, that's one of those, I will eventually watch that and then probably die the next day. Probably.
That's the, you're 2 days from retirement movie.
It's a bucket film list. I get, no, I'm just,
yeah. But you know, like you, I had heard of this, you know, as people are like, oh, you like Coen Brothers. Oh, you got to watch their first movie, Blood Simple. And I just never got around to watching it. And then you mentioned that you'd seen it and you're like, have you seen this one before? No, I had not. So yeah. It was perfect to do for the show. And I got to say, I mean, right off the bat, first of all, it's a 30-plus-year-old, almost 40-year-old movie. So we're going to be spoiling it.
Yeah.
If you care about that.
Well, yeah.
You know, that's a thing. But it is streaming right now on Max. I think, I don't think it's going away anytime soon. So, you know, you can check it there.
Yeah, this movie, I don't have a designated ranking system, but basically... This is a movie that I knew that there was a release of it, the Criterion 4K, whatever, and then I found it on streaming, and then I still went and bought it after watching it on streaming. So, like, if there's, like, a special designation for, like, movies for me, like, oh, no, this was one that I saw, and then I actually went and spent money after seeing it.
Right.
For free, whatever.
So. And honestly, totally get it. After watching the movie, I understand what was going on with this. This was really good. Everybody, if you haven't seen Blood Simple and you like thrillers, it's worth seeing. It's not perfect. I did read a thing where both the Coens have said that this is their worst movie at some point, you know, here or there, like, it's not that great, or, it's kind of rough. And I sort of get that, right? Because when you're an artist, you're your toughest critic, and you look back at the things you did when you were younger. And when you were starting, and you're gonna look at them much more critically than you do as you mature and as you grow as an artist. But man, for a feature film debut, like talk about hitting the ground running. I mean, they really did.
So I just a friend of mine from high school, really solid guy. We get along really well. We've known each other for over 20 plus years now. But I got to give him credit because he will go into a movie that I am 90% sure I will enjoy, and I'm 50-50 on if he'll take it or not. And so, like I mentioned, like, yeah, I'm gonna watch this movie and then do the podcast. And so he came over and we watched it, and it was not his kind of movie. He
Sure.
had far too many questions and thought people were doing stupid things in scenes. And I'm like, you're not wrong. But I pointed out, I'm like, I think what this really works as, like the Coen's first movie, like what you pick up on having seen other movies of theirs is there are moments where maybe the script isn't as tight or doesn't have as much eloquence to it, but there's enough visual style and the delivery of like the show don't tell storytelling that they use in this. It carry like it shifts back, it shifts its weight back and forth between what characters are saying and then showing what they're doing. And so I think it's strong enough in both that it comes out being a good movie. But if you were just to rate it on just the script or just the visuals, there's definitely moments where it's lacking at times. But yeah, I think it comes together as a whole pretty well, though.
Yeah, oh, definitely. As a whole, it's very enjoyable as long as you're into this type of movie. You've got to be into thrillers and you've got to be into movies that are pretty dark.
Yeah, there are no real heroes in this movie.
No, but
Yeah.
to your point, that's a Coen Brothers thing. Like, you look at some of their
Right.
other movies. I mean, one of their best movies, in my opinion, is No Country for Old Men. There's no true hero in that either. I mean, Llewellyn, but at the
Yeah.
same time, he's not like squeaky clean. He's not great. He just happens to be our protagonist. He also steals money. So whether it's from criminals or not is irrelevant. It wasn't his and he took it. But that's one of the things that I like about the Coens. Because you're right. Like, in a vacuum, the script is good, not great. But these are young filmmakers just out of film school.
Yeah.
So
Also, a key point that my friend was looking up while we were watching it, he's like, when is this? Like, it came out in 84. And he's like, okay, the first use of DNA in a criminal investigation was 1986. Okay. Because he's like, what? There's so much blood and DNA. We're like, this was 2 years before they started doing that. Okay. So
Yeah.
it gets a pass because of technology at the time. But like watching it now, it's like, why would anybody do any of the things they're doing the way they're doing them?
True. Yeah. And I know I did read that the title Blood Simple was from a Dashiell Hammett. There was a Dashiell Hammett novel. I can't remember which one now. I'd have to look it up. But and there was a phrase used in there of blood simple as sort of this idea of how people get when they're in these high stress situations.
Yeah, just
And
pure instinct or whatever kind of thing.
yeah. And so in a way that sort of fits, right? Because like we've got, our Ray does make some really poor decisions. Ray, played by John Getz, does some really
Yeah.
dumb things. Like, I had that in my notes. Like, okay, what are we doing with the shirt here? Like, he walks in. So, basics of the story start off with, and I love the opening, by
We
the
should
way.
talk about the plot this time. We should talk
Yes.
about the plot of the movie this time.
We
Not
should.
like 3 Days of the Condor.
But we open up with Ray and Abby, played by Frances McDormand.
Well, before that, we open up with who we don't know yet, Lauren doing the voiceover,
Oh yes.
talking about things. And what I and rewatching it this time, I did jot the note down that like the last line of that is out here in Texas, like, you're on your own. And then it cuts to the two of them in the car and they're being followed. So I was like, well, they're not on their own. They're being, so I'm like, none of this is reliable. It's all
Right.
up to, So I just was like amusing at that at on the rewatch, but yeah. But Lauren, yeah, I think this is his movie, actually. I
Oh,
think he's the main character
big
in a
time.
sense.
Yeah. Lauren, played by
Yeah.
M. Emmett Walsh, who just
Who,
recently passed away.
days after I suggested we do this for the podcast,
Yes.
passed away. I'm like, well, now we kind of have
Right.
to.
He's fantastic in this. I mean, I loved M.
Oh,
Emmett
he's so great in
Walsh in
this
so
movie.
many things, but man, he is having fun with this character, which is really interesting to me because there was the bit of trivia I read where at the we'll kind of get to it. I want to save that for a little bit later because I thought it was really funny.
Okay.
But so we open with his voiceover, and then we have Ray and Abby, and they're in the car driving at night, and they're just having this conversation, and it's a very, having watched enough Coen Brothers movies now, this is just a very Coen scene of two people having a conversation. And it's funny because you mentioned show don't tell, and there's nothing to show here, yet that's really the type of storytelling that we're doing.
The subtext paints the like visual in your mind. Well, it's rewatching it with my, like, anybody that has recommended a movie to a friend and then watches it with them and is constantly like,
yeah, you're looking over, like, making sure.
Yeah, so I'm really hearing the words. Ironically, I brought Old Brother Where Art Thou over to an aunt and uncle's house during a family get-together because I was like, oh, yeah, this just came out. It was really great. And we're, like, a fairly religious family. And I was like, I was not aware of how much actual language was in this movie until watching it with these people. But listening to their dialogue, you really can appreciate the script because it's not that anybody is, it's very much not, he worked with my mother in the Amazon while she was taking pictures of spiders before she died. It's not that type of exposition delivery, but it's like, what was that sign back there? And then she leaves it for him to say motel. So it's like, is it his idea? Is it her? She prompted. So the without saying it keeps it vague, but you get where it's going, and it's very delicately handled. The machinery of this movie is very good. I really like how it's built, basically.
Yeah, and because they're driving along, and then she gets spooked, and they realize there's a car following them, a little VW, and then the car eventually drives away, and they go to the motel, and then we just smash cut to them smash cutting each other. Yeah.
Which, and also, they very clearly also establish that this is not a thing that has happened between Ray and Abby before this night.
Yes.
So it's like a 1-2 punch of like feeling things out and, well, I like you. And, well, why are you being followed the first time that you're, oh, so then now it adds, there's like ripple effects to a lot of the actions in this.
Yep. And then in our next scene,
I just
scene,
keep sidetracking.
No, it's fine. It's fine. But in our next scene is where, we now see our Lauren, our private detective, go to the bar to talk to Dan Hedaya, another actor I love. I mean, Frances McDormand, M. Emmett Walsh, and Dan Hedaya are three great actors, and I love them in everything I see them in.
And I've seen Hedaya in mostly somewhat comedic roles.
Typically,
So it's weird to go back and actually see him in this and not like see him like aping at the camera or like, you know, hamming it up more.
He's not Nick Tortelli here.
It's a very restrained performance,
but
it's effective. It's very effective.
It's very effective. He does have an intensity to him that works here. Cause this movie is all about tension, and there's a lot of moments of just somebody staring at someone else or like unspoken things going on. And so you need to have some of that intensity between people. And he had that. And I really love,
I'll save it for when we get to it, but there's a great scene and it's articulated by a practical effect that is, it's beautiful, but we'll get to it when we get to that point in the movie.
Yeah. So he has his meeting with Lauren, who is credited as private detective, but it does say Lauren on his, lighter that he sets down. But he was contracted to follow Dan Hedaya, Julian Marty's wife, that's Abby. And he shows up with pictures of her and Ray, which I thought was kind of a cool exchange, because here's Julian looking at these pictures and he's getting very upset by them, obviously, and he even asks him, why did you take the pictures? And he's like, well, you wanted me to. And he basically was like, no, I wanted you to follow her. Why did you take the pictures? Type of thing. Like, you didn't have to do that. And you just get this sense that, like, in a way, Lauren kind of enjoyed that part, maybe more than he should.
Once you let him off the leash, you're not ready to see what he brings back to you, because he will bring something horrible back to you. And he'll grin and laugh the whole time, which just makes him delicious and horrible, but it's such a great character.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he's just so good. And you can guarantee I captured a couple of those laughs we'll hear later. Because...
Yeah.
Yeah. This exchange is great. The blocking of it, like the framing of everything, is really well done. Again, we're talking young filmmakers here, fresh out of film school, and their staging and their blocking of a lot of these shots, especially the kind of over shoulder and the way they were using the light. Who did the director? Who's the director? Oh, Sonnenfeld. Barry Sonnenfeld was the director.
Okay.
Before we get too far into the plot, I just gotta say this. So we've got first time filmmakers in Ethan and Joel Coen. They're writing this movie, they're directing this movie. Barry Sonnenfeld, this is like the second film he's done cinematography for. He'd done another film and like a music video before this. He's gone on to have a hell of a career. So you've got those two. This is Frances McDormand's first film. She's
a baby in this movie.
She looks so young. And later on, there's an uncredited Holly Hunter on an answering machine.
Yeah, on the voice. Yep.
And
you can spot her a mile away.
Oh, yeah. That voice. I had in my notes, like, Holly Hunter's voice. But she had originally auditioned for the role of Abby, but was working on a play, I think, or something, so she couldn't do it. And Frances was her roommate. So she told Frances, go do the audition. She ends up getting the role. Not only that, this is where she met Ethan Coen, and then they got married.
Yeah.
But you also had Carter Burwell doing the music for this, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later because I really liked it, but this was his first movie too. So...
Yeah, and the first time watching this, so the Criterion disc, I streamed it first, but the Criterion disc has like music playing on the menu and stuff, but as I got to the third act of the movie on the first time, and like the little bit that the little piano riff comes up, it's just, it brings you right back to like ground you into everything that is this movie. Mm-hmm. So it's very effective. It's simple, similar to like the Jaws theme. It's like when you hear it, you know what it is.
Yes.
And this, if somebody played that on a piano, I would turn my head and be like, oh, they know.
Yeah. Well, and I was getting similar feelings from the music from The Usual Suspects that John Ottman did. That very simple piano piece. Same kind of feel that I got here, where it's like Jaws is a great one because it's a very simple little melody, but it earworms. Yeah. It gets right in there, and it does anchor you to this movie and anchor you to what was going on in it. So I had to mention all those people because this is like the movie that launched a half dozen careers right here. I mean,
there's a lot of creative vision and mindfulness, but there's also a lot of like passion involved in everybody. It's not like anybody just showed up because this is the next thing slated for them to work on before they move. Like everyone was on this because they wanted to make it what it is. And so even if it isn't like 100% perfect, like you can appreciate it because they were really putting it into it.
Yeah. So after Julian pays him, he throws the money at Lauren. Lauren takes his money and just cackles on his way out. And we get...
Well, hold on. Have you skipped to coming back from the trip? Or are you talking about... Oh, no. When he pays him for the pictures and the envelope falls on the ground.
Yeah, he pays him for the pictures and he picks up the envelope and he leaves. And then we get Maurice at the bar. He's chatting with a young lady when Julian comes out. My note here was, man, Julian is just a bona fide creeper for this whole scene. Yeah. He is just sleazy. And again, if you're not used to Dan Hedaya being like serious and not jokey, it's a little, arresting to have, that going on. Cause like dude is just creepy.
Yeah. Well, I think it's watching it now, having seen him in more comedic roles, it almost kind of gets into that weird, somewhat uncomfortably familiar territory of your friend that will say that thing that sets some people off, but you know they're never going to actually do anything about it. Mm-hmm. But like in this, I'm like, oh no, no, we got to watch out for him. Like he's going to do it.
Yeah. He is going, he's going to do something very uncomfortable. So, so
someone to do it.
Right. So now he knows that his wife is having an affair. And yeah. that like, so he's wondering where does this one Ray comes in? Ray comes in a little bit later to the bar.
Well, yeah, Ray. Yeah. So there's the, this is the first night that they're together at the hotel.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and yes. And they get the phone morning. Call. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is, it's funny because watching how many of these things get called back later in the movie, like, oh, he didn't say, how do you know it was a him? And it was, you know, and it sets up another moment later where you don't hear a voice and she just assumes she knows who it is.
Right.
But it's also in the very beginning, like, I'm not a marriage counselor, which it's just a dumb line. But then later when Ray goes to the bar and is like, what are you, some kind of marriage counselor? And Ray smirks and that sets him up. Like, we know why he's smirking because it is funny to us. Mm-hmm. But then Marty's like, is that funny to you? Like,
it's great too. Yeah.
That plays with your brain. Yeah.
It's so well, like that's clever writing and clever execution because like we know why Ray would smirk, but Julian has no idea why he would smirk. And so
we're in on the joke.
Yeah. We're in on that. And so, you know, his reaction is genuine and makes perfect sense why he would kind of react that way. So I love stuff like that.
And it's subtle. It's not like he bust out. He just like his lip twitched, but it mm-hmm. was enough that my friend watching it with me, his one of his comments was like, everyone's doing stupid things. They're not thinking clearly and they're taking way too long to do all of it, which yes, it is a very, it's a short movie, but it is very slowly paced. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate how it's delivered, but I could also see how if someone's like, okay, we get the point. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But take 5 minutes to walk across the room. Okay. Don't turn that light off immediately when you just said someone might be shooting at you. Don't,
right.
You know, there's some, we can get into it later, but like, watching this, because you kind of think Ray might be the, I guess as a straight white male, I'm assuming that Ray is like the main character, but he really isn't of this movie.
Right.
And if anything, he's just kind of a bumbling idiot. the personification of naivete and innocence. Just keeps doing stupid things for what he thinks are right reasons. But everyone else is just like in it for themselves. And yeah, but it, okay, go, you go, you steer the ship.
Yeah. Well, okay. So then when Ray comes in and he's like, hey, you know, is Julian here? And Julian's sitting out back. And I love this scene. I really like this exchange because it's, you know, it's that classic trope of like the two guys feeling each other out and sort of circling each other. But
yeah,
but the way it's all delivered, like I love when Ray starts to talk to him and Julian's response is like, I don't particularly want to talk to you right now.
Yeah.
And
it's like when you see the very tall, like muscular guy go quiet and it's like, oh no, when he goes quiet, that's when you have to start worrying. Yeah. Like when he stops talking, that's when you, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it was
less is very much more.
And it felt like a real exchange between two people that are at odds because there was a lot of in this, one person knows more than the other person, and we as an audience mm-hmm. know that. And watching yeah. that play out, that back and forth play out, where like at this point, Ray doesn't know necessarily that Julian knows. He thinks so, but he's not 100%. But Julian knows more than Ray thinks, but you know, it's all this like, it's very convoluted and very intricately woven.
Yeah.
And I just like, I like that kind of cat and mouse that goes on as they're feeling each other and out and saying things without saying them.
Yeah. And like the distinction between the end result is not much different than had it gone the other way, mm-hmm. but Ray standing there and Julian sitting on the back steps with the bug zapper right next to him. And Ray's like, so am I fired? And it's like, well, if you ain't going to fire me, I might as well quit. And it's like thinking about that as an exchange between two people. It's like, this is very much dependent on, is this an action that Julian is taking as retribution for what Rey has done?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it, no, Rey acknowledges that if you're not going to treat it as you could, I will. There's a weird respect between them in a sense.
Kind of, yeah.
It's very much like a gentlemanly, like, I can't do this, but I am going to kill you, but I can't do it this way kind of thing. Like,
yeah. And like the whole thing when Rey's like, okay, and he just leaves, and you get Julian telling him, look, if you set foot on the property again, I'm going to have to shoot you.
Yeah.
And like waits for him to be gone. It's like, I've given you fair warning, you know, where they don't like each other, but they're begrudgingly respectful of each other in that moment. Like, we might settle this, but we're not going to do it right now. Like, neither one of us are really in the headspace to tackle this right now. So why don't you just leave, type of thing, or I'll just leave.
Yeah.
So I did like that. And that's
where the bug zapper moment where Dan Hedaya is going on like a little bit of a rant where is that funny? What's funny? And it's like, it's building. And it's the first time he's kind of like leaning into like the tone and the emotion and it builds. And then the bug zapper, which has been there the whole time, not really doing anything. Just, they must've had somebody on the side, like throwing dead flies into it.
Yeah. Something
like, it was perfect timing. There's no, I did also make a side note about all of M. Emmett Walsh's bug acting. The man will just be a statue and let anything crawl on his eyes and his face, and he'll just keep in here. I'm like, that's creepy. Like, that adds to it. But yeah, I love the bug zapper just articulating the moment. But it also is like, that seemed like when there's a lot of times people are caught up in a moment, and then an external force will snap everybody out of it into, oh, right, yeah, we're standing on the side of a street. We need to collect ourselves.
Yeah. And I think, too, it's also, it's the moment, like, it sets up stuff later on, because here's Julian telling him, you know what I think is funny is when she's going to tell you, I don't know what you're talking about, and all this stuff.
Right.
And it works in the moment. It's perfect there. And when they call back to it later, it's one of those, like, you're just like, oh, well done. Well, golf clap. Like, well done, gentlemen, on your script here. But it's also...
Like, why was she being followed the first time he considered maybe doing anything? So it was like, this was not... He wasn't following Rey. He was following Abby.
Mm-hmm.
So
why
was he following... Okay. Rey was in a bigger situation than he expected.
So. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Very much so. And I think this is the moment where Julian decides he wants to have them killed. I don't think prior to Rey showing up, he was going to go through with that. Like, he was upset. But I think something in that exchange with Rey and how it all went, that's what pushed him over the edge, so that when we see him going to Lauren at the whatever, like, lookout point or whatever that's supposed to be, which was another another thing I really dug that scene, because it felt like a real place. Because, you know, a lot of times those...
Where the kids go.
Yeah.
And this old man in a yellow suit is hanging out, enjoying it. Like, oh, dude, wrong scene for you.
No, but at the same time, there's something really just, like, Coen Brothers movie wonderful about that, because it feels... So many times you get the clandestine meeting at the dock or at the lookout or whatever, and it's just the two people in the middle of the night. And this is great because it's that, but there's stuff going on around them too. Like when they're sitting in the car and you get the occasional like person walk behind the car and you just see a silhouette. And I really enjoyed that. So he goes to him to contract him to kill his wife and Rey, Abby and Rey.
Mm-hmm.
And there again is that, what this movie did really well, which is to kind of, the dialogue talks around a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Nobody really wants to fully commit. They all have the idea, but they don't want to like say it. It's like, if I say it, it becomes a thing and it shows intention. And so it's just like the, what did that sign say back there?
Yeah.
Hotel. And then it's like, that is your answer, but you didn't get. And then this is very much like, what do you want? Oh, I did love the, like, well, as long as it pays right, it's not illegal. Like, well, as long as it pays right.
Yep,
like,
exactly.
He's not saying I won't do it, but he's like, they get to the response without actually declaring it openly.
Yep.
So
absolutely.
There's a vagueness and a,
And which again does feel like people trying to set up something like this, that maybe have read a lot of novels and or seen movies, and they feel like Julian thinks this is the way he has to go about it. And so that's how he's going to go about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Given all the things I've experienced and other evidence I know of, this is the next logical progression.
I also just thought it was hilarious. He gets him in the car, they sit down, and he pulls the little string on the the hula dancer booby lights hanging from his rearview mirror.
Did you pull this line?
Did
you pull that line?
I did not. But it was really
good. Wild? That's so great.
I mean, honestly, I could have captured everything Emmett Walsh said in
this. Oh, yeah. And it's all good.
As it is, most of my clips are him anyway, but...
he really does stand out in this movie. The movie does not work without him, but it's effectively not about him. But it is his movie, because he's really the only one that kind of has any idea of what's actually happening and is just trying to navigate around everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
But
and I was wrong. I'm just remembering the scene with Ray and Julian is not where he decides he's going to kill them. That's when he goes to, is it Ray's house? The next morning.
Oh, yes, because she wakes up and Opal's in the house, and then pulls her out front, and then they're standing there, and my friend's commenting like, "Yeah, man, just slowly walk out onto your lawn while your girl's ex is whatever. Just take your time with it." Yeah, but it was a great comedic Cohen moment of like, I would have loved to have seen his face when he got to the end of the cul-de-sac. like turn around and drive back by him.
Well, and on top of the fact that, like, you know, he drags her out front and she turns around and just gives him one swift kick to the junk. Which is preceded by a very Sam Raimi Evil Dead camera move, right? That push in camera move, which. When I thought about it,
there's a lot of active camera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I thought about that and I'm like, oh, well, they were friends with Sam Raimi, the Coens were. So it kind of makes sense that they would have, you know, they would have probably been influencing each other. But she kicks him. So he of course, gets nailed right in the junk and then throws up on the front lawn. And here again is a whole lot of things being said between people without any words. There's not a lot of dialogue here. There's just a lot of looks.
Yeah.
And then, I love that line. When he gets in the car and he takes off and he's got to turn around and drive back by him. It was really, really good. That's the moment when he decided, all right, now I'm gonna have that.
The show. Humility on top of this. Yeah. It was like, okay, now I'm over the edge. Yeah. But,
So he goes, he contracts Lauren to do the deed and says, and Lauren's like, all right, go out of town. Like, go fishing. Go to Corpus Christi or whatever it is. So then, let's see. That's when he goes. So now the PI goes to the house to find them. And he breaks in and he takes her gun. And he notices there's only...
He doesn't even have to break it.
Oh, that's true. They don't have the door.
Ray doesn't lock his door. Ray doesn't... I will agree. My friend pointed out a lot of things. Like, Ray is just like the naive, clean slate walking into these... pre-existing combustive elements, because it's like, well, I think you're pretty and I know I work for your husband, but I could sleep with you, and then okay, well, I gotta go do this thing because I'm the man and I'm protecting you, and okay, I put my jeans on so I can come out and tell your ex-husband that he has to leave. It's like Ray is kind of just adults. But following him around, like seeing and again, the character is expressed through what they think they understand and the realization of what's actually happening, which is a very unique way of doing it. But you only know so much about Ray. I don't know why he moved back to town.
Yeah.
Dan Hedaya mentions to Abby, like, you thought he moved back for you. And it's like, we don't know where he came from. And then he packs up in this and he's about to leave again. It's like, did you even sign a lease? Like,
what's going on?
It's 84. Maybe it's different times. Like, I don't know.
Yeah,
but
that's
I'm
true.
Like, they can just up and go. And then she gets an apartment in the course of like 3 days. She leaves, stays at Ray's a day or two, and then gets her own apartment. A lot of things happen in a short amount of time.
They do. But Coens did that quite a bit, like that sort of thing. And it
fits stylistic.
Oh, it does. Absolutely. And Ray kind of, as I think about it, reminds me a bit, not in a characterization manner, but sort of in what he brings to the story. He reminds me of the dude in a lot of ways from Big Lebowski. Yeah. He's just there. He exists in this world, and there's all sorts of stuff happening around him that is either going over his head or is like, ancillary to what he's doing himself, but he's involved in, and he just doesn't, he's not really like consciously on that level. And,
it's almost like a step up from like a Chaplin or Buster Keaton, like fool type role, where it's like, oh, I have very limited expectations, and watch me in these grand situations that I shouldn't be in.
Yeah.
But he has an awareness of it, but he only has so much awareness of it. He can't conceive of things beyond his own information. And then once he starts to realize that, oh, they're like planting the seed of Abby could have been sleeping with other people before this. And then like watching that, like those little rocks fall into the pond and the ripples start to form. It's like, huh? Like,
yeah, no, you're not wrong.
He does it well enough, but there's also kind of a reason why he's the one person in this movie I really hadn't seen in anything before this. Like, I've seen Francis McDormand. I've seen a lot of these other people in other movies.
Yeah.
But John Getz. Okay.
I mean, he's done other stuff, but I can't think of him from anything. He's not overly memorable. He's fine in this, though. I think in this, he fits and he works well.
It fits the role. Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah.
So let's see what else happens here. I mean, now we get a lot of kind of back and forth when he takes the gun and then we just,
well, Lauren's at the house. We were at Lauren at the house.
Yeah. Yeah.
To kill them.
Mm-hmm.
And then he doesn't kill them. He takes the pictures and he doctors them.
Right. Although we don't see that happen. We just see him at the house and then we see him returning to the bar with the photos of like, hey, the deed is done. And as that scene was unfolding, it did not go the direction that I thought it was going to go at all. I will be completely honest.
Okay.
So Lauren comes to the bar, to Julian, brings him the photo and says, hey, here's the deed. It's done. And he pulls out the photo. He looks at it and it's Ray and Abby and they're covered in blood. And as I'm watching this, I was like, but we didn't see it happen, but it's the Coen brothers and they're not, they've done, like, I've seen movies of theirs before where characters have died off screen. So maybe he did. Maybe, like, I wasn't sure for most of that if he had or not. And then as they're doing, and it's a very tense scene. There's a lot of these really tense moments in this. And it's this tense exchange between Lauren and Julian. And then he finally pays him and gives him his money. And that's when he, up until the moment where Lauren reaches into his pocket and cocks the gun, I was like, okay, so I guess maybe he didn't, like, he did kill them and he's getting paid. And then he cocks the gun. I'm like, did he? And then he shoots Julian. And I was like, my note was, I probably should have seen that coming, but I did not.
With Abby's gun.
Yes.
There's so much that happens in that scene that I did. Okay, so for one thing, I watched this. I may have had an edible before I watched it. I also work nights, and I tend to break movies into parts because I fall asleep.
Sure.
I think I dozed off briefly for a moment in this, or I just wasn't completely coherent, because it was rewatching it, prepping for this, that I was like, oh. I just thought they were like, man, those fish must really stink by this point. They've just been sitting on the desk for days. And I was completely unaware of Lauren put his lighter. He put a Zippo on the table, on the desk.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Marty comes back over and puts the second thing of fish down on it, and it keeps showing it like Hitchcockian psycho, keeps showing it in the shot. And I'm like, didn't even connect that's what it was the whole first viewing. And so this watching it, I'm like, oh, okay, he thought he was okay, but he left that there, and then he went back to get stuff out of the safe, and then okay, things fell into place. I also wasn't 100% sure on what was up with the bartender guy at first, because they made a big deal out of that first scene, and then again I must have dozed off the first time because I missed the part of well, you sure you got the money cleared? It's like, yeah, it's covered. It's taken care of. The less you know about it, the better you are. And I didn't get the part where he basically called the bartender and accused him of stealing the money. The only black guy in the all white Texas bar who has enough security that he can walk through the crowd of people and put on Motown in the middle of Texas bar. It was like, oh, okay. So you're just going to sell him under the bus or throw him under the bus and say he took the money, but then he knows Ray probably. Yeah. So I missed that little detail and I missed the lighter part the first time, but I think it was substances affecting my awareness, but yeah,
that's entirely possible. But
it definitely makes more sense when you know that stuff though.
Oh, for sure. For sure. But it's a great scene. And then it ends that way and he leaves and then Ray shows up to get money. He goes to the till and there's nothing in there, but he sees the light on. Yeah. So that's when he goes in. And this is where I was like, okay, Ray, you're dumb and you're making really dumb decisions here. But
yeah,
I have to remember that it's like, but it's also my 30 years of watching police procedurals on TV are making me think these things. But he walks in and like he starts, he's just touching everything and
he kicks the gun.
He does.
Which it's almost not enough show. Like you get it because of you see that Lauren had kicked it away. Mm-hmm. But then Ray walks in and I'm thinking like, this gun is on its side. And if he kicks it with his foot, how is it possible that it hits the banister right next to his hands and goes across? I'm like, okay, that's a little bit of a hard to split. That's a little bit of a suspension of disbelief, but I get where they're okay.
Yeah.
But again, that's one of those like blink and you miss it. And it kind of derails a lot of what follows it. But yeah, it is like, yeah, he kicks the gun and then the scene earlier with the bartender coming in and saying like, Marty, I thought you were dead, sitting in the chair when he was just relaxing.
Right.
And then, oh yeah, no, he's just going to be dead the rest of the movie in that chair. So.
And then it proceeds to be like a very
talk
long...
about Ray being an idiot.
Yeah. Well, and then it's just this very long couple of scenes of him first figuring out that Julian's been shot and he's dead in the chair. And then trying to move him.
Yeah.
And then Maurice shows up and now he's trying to clean the blood off the floor with his shirt.
And it's dripping everywhere.
And it's just dripping like everywhere. And I'm thinking, what are you doing with this? And he walks it to the sink, dripping the whole way to clean it off. I'm like, okay, that's probably not going to work, but sure. And then he wraps it in a towel to go back to clean more before taking the body and getting out of there while Maurice and people are in the other room. He just locked the door and like did all this. So
I think this is when my friend pointed out 1986, 2 years after this movie, is when they started using DNA in crime scenes. It's like, there's blood everywhere. Well, we can't do anything about it.
Yeah. But then he loads him into his car, and then we get the really long scene where he's driving, and he's listening to the radio. And again, pacing-wise, yes, this is a very deliberately paced movie. But it sort of works for me. It too, because I like that slow, because Ray's kind of got to sit in this moment and sort of figure out what's going on. And I don't know what spooked him to get out of the car.
Oh, he heard Marty breathing.
Oh, that's what it was. Okay. Cause I had to kind of go back to it a couple times.
Yeah. He heard Marty breathe, which is surprising that all of that time, nothing happened until that moment in the car.
Yeah.
But it's the movie, you know, it works for the movie, you know. And then I also felt like that truck coming up over the horizon or up over the hill in the distance took so long to actually get to the car, but it was treated as like it's going to be here any second, but it was like almost a full 2 minutes before the truck actually got there. But yeah, a lot of this was like people feeling forced to make the decision that they didn't want to make or they wanted to make but weren't fully committed to it. So now they have just enough to push them into a justification for why they have to do it, which I think is people can tell themselves it's the right reasons or anything, but it's like he, that little bit puts you over it. Yeah.
But so Ray first gets spooked, runs out of the car, and then when he comes back over to it, now
runs a great distance out of the car.
He does. And when he comes back, the door's open and there's no more Julian in the back seat. and he slowly walks around the car, and there's Julian. And it's very, I've seen this in the trailers. I remember that, where it's Julian crawling, trying to like get somewhere. And my first thought was, how in the world is he alive? But sure, we'll go with it.
Yeah.
And it's just this very slow burn of Ray walking up behind him and then coming back and grabbing the shovel like he's going to hit him. And he keeps wrestling with this idea of like, can I go through with this or not? Do I have this in me? And he's about to when the truck is coming over the horizon. So then he puts the shovel back and he like wrestles with Julian to get him back to the car just in time as the truck is driving by. And then we get him like taking him out in a field. And this is where I was like, oh, he's going to bury him alive. Like, holy crap. He knows he's not dead yet, but he's still going to bury him anyway. And it's like, you know,
but he thinks Abby shot him.
Yes,
because
that's
true. He saw the gun. Mm-hmm. So it's not so much he feels he needs to do this for himself. He feels that he's doing it for Abby as well.
That is a very good point. Yes.
And so it's like, if she could, because when he comes back, he's like, well, you gotta, if you use it, you gotta make sure you do the job. You make sure you get it done. Which, yeah, that's where like the real subtext between characters really starts to get fun. Yeah,
and they kind of play the pronoun game and you know, say stuff without actually saying it.
Right.
So that,
and a lot of it's very well worded. That, well, it's taken care of. It's like, well, you didn't tell me what was taken care of, but he is answering what he believes to have been her question. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's all vague.
And he does when they are having a conversation is so after Ray buries Julian. And there is one last exchange, because somewhere along the line, Julian got the revolver and he tries to shoot Ray, but it happens to
Ray
be
put it in the pocket before they left the office.
That's what it was. Again, it's one of those things you can blink and miss it and then not know what's going on.
And I don't think Julian knew it was in there until he was in the grave and kind of like shifted to that side. So I think he could probably feel it. And then because he reached for it, like he knew it was there the whole time. But and I guess I do, to a certain degree, there is an element of shock when, you know, when Ray's holding the gun up when Julian's holding the gun up to Ray and Ray's just standing there. And again, my friend's like, what do you do? Just move out. Get out of the. But it's like, I guess I could, in Ray's situation, there's probably these are the consequences for my actions. Like he was ready to accept it. And then when it wasn't going to happen and he just reaches down and takes the gun. And it's a very Cohen. We're going to bring you to this point. We're going to make you think, you know, what's going to happen. And then something else is going to happen. And we're going to branch off from that. So yeah,
they're very good at doing that. And then that's when he goes back and he talks to Abby. And when they when they finally get up the next morning, they're having their exchange, and that's where we have that other shoe drop moment where she says, "What are you talking about?" And it's exactly what Julian told him she would say. That she would look at him and she would say, "I don't know what you're talking about." And here again is that moment where we watch Ray's reaction to what she's saying, and we know why he's reacting the way that he is, but she doesn't know why, and so her reaction makes perfect sense. And it's that great moment there, but they do still trust each other enough that because he thought he was doing her a favor, and she doesn't really know exactly what he did.
Right. Finishing what she started. And now, and again, when she starts to realize what has happened and like, he did that. And it's like, he thought you did it and he finished. But so, and then none of these people know who actually, I don't even know if Abby in the end of the movie knows that Lauren killed Ray. He does say something about, if I see him, I'll pass along the message. But I don't think that she has any inclination that he's the one that killed him.
No, not at all. In fact,
she could probably figure it out once. Yeah.
But the funny thing is that Ray and Lauren and Abby and Lauren all have scenes that they're in together, but neither Ray nor Abby ever actually see Lauren like face to face.
Right.
which is pretty cool.
Yes, yes.
Like
well, yeah, because they see it right at the beginning of the movie. He's following them.
Mm-hmm, but they don't actually know. And like, they don't see him. They just see his car.
He's seeing them more than they're seeing him.
Yeah.
He's there the whole time, basically, almost.
Which leads to your point where you mentioned it's kind of his movie, and sort of he is the one that knows everything, because
yeah,
Ray knows somebody is out to get him by the end. So by the end, like, Lauren has gone back to the bar to try and break into the safe to get the picture back, because he realized that Julian kept the photo and slipped employees must wash hands.
Yeah.
Which was great when they have that shot where you see the handwritten version of that on the board in the background.
And it's played up a lot on the second viewing. Lauren does make a very explicit comment as Marty is walking towards the safe. I want to need all them back. Like, so yeah, they very clearly reference it. And then it's one of those, like, if you don't see Marty, like, fold it and put it in alongside when Lauren opens the envelope later, it's just like, why is this sign in here? Like, this is,
but yeah,
he knew how many photos were in there. So he knows that there's some of it doesn't always stick on the first viewing, but it really comes into focus on the second. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. he realizes that he doesn't have the photo. So he goes back to get it from the safe, but then he's interrupted.
Still doesn't know where his lighter is.
Right. Yeah. Which I guess he just didn't smoke for several hours, which seems unlikely.
My friend commented on that. Yeah, because it's like all that whole scene with Ray bringing Marty out to the farmland and making a very inconspicuous set of tire tracks to the middle of the field and then driving over where he apparently I'm like, nobody's going to ever find him here. Like, what are you doing? But yeah, after all of that time passes, then Lauren's like, I better light up. Like, wait, where's my Zippo?
Uh-huh.
Like, you just now.
So yeah. when he goes back, then he gets interrupted by Abby showing up. And
yes.
And so
but
now
Lauren's back. Yeah.
Yeah. So now we've got Abby thinks Ray went to the bar, and Lauren knows that Abby has shown up, and Ray thinks that Abby has killed. Like, we've got all these.
And
these
I don't think
threads.
Abby knows anything about Lauren. He's
no,
just a guy. Doesn't
she doesn't
know
at all.
About him.
Like, she's assuming.
So she's, who is this?
Well, when she gets there, he hides and she finds the hammer and she thinks it was Ray. She thinks, like, Ray was trying to break in somehow.
Right, right. Yeah, because he's hiding from her before a later scene when she's hiding from him. That's what I'm getting confused.
Yeah.
But yeah, because then when Ray comes back, he's like, this is not how I left the safe. Because Ray has the combination. He didn't need to.
Right.
So now it's like, there's more going on here than anybody's aware of,
And that is a fun plot device to have, you know, A knows about B, B knows about C, and C knows about D, but none of them know about A. Like, that kind of thing going on. I really like that. As long as you can keep everything straight. And
it definitely has a certain, like, shelf life before it's like, okay, we've exhausted our options and now we have to just figure out an answer. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's only so many of those threads you can have before it's too many.
Yeah. And I feel like having watched it twice, I do feel like there are two distinct halves. There's the setup and the construction of, like, the subtext apparatus of everything and the interconnectedness. And I feel like that is all very well done, paced, established. I'm not saying I dislike the ending of the movie, but, like, once there's less intrigue and watching people figure things out and more just watching it play out, it just kind of like, okay, let's just wrap this up in the next 15 minutes and then get people home. Because, like, you're not doing a lot of mental heavy lifting at that point, but it kind of just it almost becomes like a horror movie in a sense.
Yeah, kind of.
Like a slasher movie, but it's not. I mean, she's more of the villain, physically doing more to him than he did to her, but it
still does make for a very tense scene. That end scene in the
apartment absolutely
is incredibly tense. And so we've had the exchange there, and then Ray and Abby at Ray's house.
He's packing up to leave.
He's packing up to leave, which again had a great moment with sound where they're face to face, they're talking, and then that newspaper hits the door like a gunshot was just amazing. Like, that was enough. I had to rewind it and watch it again. I'm like, I need to see that another time. Yeah.
And it's not one of those we cut to it just as it happens. Like, it's on that shot. It's like, I was just mentioning slash, it's like in the first Halloween, and like, you see, you're looking out the window, and then like the silhouette steps, and you're like, oh, I wasn't expecting that. Yeah. There, it's like, it's on that shot so long. And then,
And so something happens. They end up separated. When she shows up at her apartment, Ray's already there. And he's all paranoid because he knows somebody's chasing him, like somebody's after him.
That when she goes to the house, so she goes to the bar. She sees that there's damage to the safe and there's fish on the desk and whatever. She has not heard from Marty.
Yeah.
Is it when is it that she gets the phone call? Is it at Ray's house? She gets the phone call and it's actually Lauren, but she thinks it's Marty.
Yeah, I think so.
No, that's at the end of it. Oh, that's at the end of it.
That is at the end. At her apartment. Yeah, yeah.
So she still doesn't know if Marty is alive or not. But yeah, she just thinks, what did you do? And he thinks he's cleaning up her mess. And there's, so it's all just confusion. And then that paper, like the bug zapper, just zaps them, snaps them back to like, oh, we've got to keep doing things. Like, we can't just sit here trying to figure out what's happening. And
we end at her apartment. So she goes back to her apartment and she has a dream where she sees Marty. Then she leaves, comes back. Ray is there. Lauren's like across the street with a rifle, it looks like getting ready to shoot at them. And we just get that super tense final scene where so Ray gets shot through the glass.
Yeah.
And he's down and she's hiding. So Lauren has to come across the street and get into the building. And she hides in the bathroom. So when he comes in, he ends up, and I love the way that all played out. When he goes into the bathroom, because obviously your first thought is like, well, she couldn't get away, so she must be hiding in the shower, which he's gonna look in. And as the camera moves and you realize there is nowhere else she could be.
Yeah. It's also a very large open bathroom. Like, this is not really efficient, but it looked very soundstagey to me. It just looked like we have our walls and our two things we can afford to purchase for the room.
Yeah. I mean, it is a loft. So like, I kind of get that too, but it was like, I just loved that
they showed you every square inch of that room. Like, nowhere for her to have gone.
Yeah, there's nowhere. And we'd seen her like open the window and look outside and there's nowhere to go there. So then when he does the same thing and now you're like, well, where the hell is she? And that's when he realizes there's a window, you know, the next apartment over. And that's your like horror movie kind of moment, right? It's again, super tense.
Yeah.
And when he reaches over to that and she grabs his hand and slams the window on it and puts a knife right through it and just like staples him to that windowsill. And while all this is going on and he starts shooting holes in the wall and he's like punching at the wall, trying to break through it and get his hand back and all this kind of stuff. And all that's going on and we've got music playing, but it's in the background from like another apartment.
Yeah.
And there was something about like that whole atmosphere I really, really dug. I just, it felt, there was a feel to that I really enjoyed.
Yeah. Well, that's what, when he's reaching around and she stabs his hand, like, again, that felt very horror movie. And I guess this is 84. So like late 70s, early 80s, that this is kind of that era is, but it's a more sophisticated take on that, I guess. But then there's like a pause and the first bullet comes through and the shaft of light. And the next bullet comes through. And it was like, that was just signature Coen Brothers. Like that, we're not going to tell you what happens next. We're just going to have it like, pot shots coming through the wall. Okay. Mm-hmm. That felt very Coen. And
it did. Yeah. It absolutely did. And she ends up leaving that other apartment, coming back into hers. she's hiding. He gets himself free. He busts through the wall, gets his hand free.
Yeah.
And is making his way to leave the bathroom. And she thinks it's Ray at this point.
She doesn't know who it is yet. Yeah. She hasn't seen him.
And so
she thinks it's not Ray.
Marty. Sorry. She thinks it's Marty. And shoots him through the door.
Yeah.
With the final bullet she had, because she only had three bullets in that gun, and all three of them get fired.
Yeah.
But she
one on purpose, one by accident.
Yep.
And then one on purpose.
So she shoots him. He goes down, and that's when she says, "You know, was it something, Marty?" Or and that's when again Lauren just starts laughing and has that great line of like, "If I see him, I'll tell him." You know, oh, I'm not afraid of you, Marty. That's what it was.
Yeah, yeah. And then and my friend did comment. He's like, "So what was up with that water dripping at the end?" And I'm like, I think it's his perspective. And again, if we're taking this on, Lauren is the main character of the movie. Mm-hmm. It starts with his intro and then him following, and it ends when he dies. And for a half a moment, I thought, because they kind of reversed the shot a little bit of the water dribbling. And I was like, is this going to be like an Inception? Like it never drops and you just get left. But it did. And then
And that's
kind of that just felt like a cute little filmmaky thing. Like, we're just going to show this.
That's some film student stuff right there. You know, this movie has, again, there's that seed and those roots of like, these people really know what they're doing and the passion that's behind it. Because again, for a first feature, and there were at least two different moments in this where they had wonderfully put together match cuts, which you don't get that without planning it out and well-directed and then well-edited moments.
Yeah. So there are match cuts, but then there are also transitions.
Yes.
There's two specific transitions with Frances McDormand's where the first one, like she leans into frame and then Ray's hand comes up and then she goes down, day turns to night. And then she comes back up and she's facing the opposite direction. It's like she went facing down and she came up, and I'm pretty sure it's one shot and they just had the lighting shift outside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, there's another shot like, when she's in the office, because you never see her leave Ray's office. You just see her there, and then she like falls back and does the turn to the pillow.
Yes, which is one I absolutely love.
Long before so many other movies have done that kind of thing. This is long before most of them have done that. So
yeah, that was such a
great. It feels old, but it is. Yeah.
It was such a great transition. It's almost almost Hitchcockian kind of transition. Is what it felt like to me, like a shot that he would devise at some point. And then that match cut of Maurice going to hit the either play or stop button on his answering machine, match cut to Ray like touching the blood stain in the backseat of his car.
Yes,
was another one of those. And I'm just like, man, to be able to devise these so early in your career is really impressive, because it's memorable. Like those are shots I'm going to remember.
Yeah, on a second viewing, there once you know the context and the weight of certain actions and words, there are a lot of things that you can start to see like peppered in early on. That having seen it before, you're like, when Maurice goes out back, he's like, "Oh, Ray, Marty, I thought you were dead," and it's like. Well, he will be, but it's just an innocuous line early on. I wish we had more with Maurice, because I feel like he was given a lot very early on, and then it kind of just didn't go anywhere. Because I started to rewatch it the second time, and I was thinking, they put a lot of time and effort into this first introduction with this guy. And I really like the part with the girl at the bar, and then Marty comes over, and then all of this. Like, how long have you known Maurice? Da, da, da. And then at the end, it ends with, "So what'd you say your last name was again?" And it's like, everyone's kind of playing somebody, but they kind of all have an idea of what they know the other person is capable of. So they're holding their cards as well.
But. Yeah. No, it's just really good stuff, and I enjoyed all the performances. I did capture a little bit of audio. I need to play a couple of these just because.
Oh, yeah.
These are too good. If you listen to this show enough, you know me. I love a good laugh, and M. Emmett Walsh has a couple of great ones in here. So here's one of them. That's like almost a clown laugh, and then it's that inhale right after. Just I really liked, and then his longer one. I think this is him leaving. I want to say this is him leaving with his money, maybe, but this one was just longer, and it just killed me.
I think that's the end of the movie.
That's the end of the movie. Yeah, because then there's the cough at the end of it. It's him laying on the floor.
When Marty slides the money over with his boot, which I love that he won't even give it the dignity of like putting his hands on it. He's just like, here, mm-hmm. take your slimy, dirty blood money that I believe. Again, that's the thing is, everyone believes that somebody else has done a thing that they have not done.
Yes.
That's a consistency through all of it. So mm-hmm. And that's what I was mentioning to my friend, because I was like, even the guy who's the sleaze and gets paid to do these things won't commit to actually doing them. He'd rather Photoshop something and then play it off. But mm-hmm. yes, he can play it off as Abby killed him, and then I don't have to deal with the consequences of this.
Yeah.
Also, for a second, I'm like, why wouldn't he just rob Marty while he has the safe open? But like, he just wants his money and he wants to go and be clear of it, because he doesn't want people to know that he didn't actually do the thing that he was hired to do. But yeah, it a lot of inaction and suspicion. And then,
absolutely. There was a moment. So at the end, when he picks up his hat and puts it back on, Lauren, I did like the trivia of Joel Cohen had trouble convincing M. Emmett Walsh to pick up his hat off the ground in the movie's climactic ending scene. Walsh had a laundry list of reasons why his character just wouldn't do that. He's like, no.
Really?
But Cohen kept trying and trying and kept failing to debate with him. And finally, he said to him, will you please just humor me? And this is the best response. Now, IMDb trivia, grain of salt. Obviously, but Cohen, will you please just humor me? Walsh, I'm humoring you by doing this whole fucking movie. That's just like, I hope that actually happened, because that's great. That is just but a also, great moment from like a veteran actor, probably the oldest guy on the set at all, with this young filmmaker who wants the thing. And I have been in that position. Not on a like major film set, but working on projects with friends of mine. And, you know, the person directing the scene is like, okay, I want you to do this. And the guy acting it out is like, but I wouldn't do that. Like, but the character that I'm playing wouldn't do that. And they argue back and forth until finally, could you just do it for me to just humor me? And like, you get to that point. So that was just a great exchange. And I had to mention that, because like, I can totally see the old guy being like, kid, I'm here. That's humoring you enough.
Yeah. Well, it's in a weird, I guess, attempt to segue it back or circle it all back together. In a weird sense, a film being made is a lot of individual people working towards the same goal who have their understanding of their role and the importance of it. Mm-hmm. But like, yeah, you show up on the day and you're wearing the wardrobe and you're saying the lines, but the guy shooting it really needs to get it from this angle, and you think you've given your best performance. It's like, oh, so in a sense, it kind of fits like the nature of the story itself. Like, you only know so much, and there's more going on here than, But I would say, in retrospect, if that's the one shot they got of him getting his head off the floor, I'm like, I definitely see it being, it feels like a very, like a resignation. Like, he kind of knows, like, well, I'm kind of just screwed, so I may as well just put my hat on and then face the music or whatever, you know. So if he just tried to slink out of there, it would be in his nature, but it wouldn't be like a fitting end, I don't think.
Another audio clip. I got a couple from M.M. Walsh in the car. I just loved the phrasing of this, which was...
Now he's got two busted flippers.
Two busted flippers. Because he's telling the story of this guy that broke his hand, and he had a cast on, and then he fell, so he put out his good hand to brace his fall, and then he broke the other hand. And it's like, now he's got two busted flippers, and I just want to call my arms flippers now, forever. I just want to use that phrase. And also, there was this, and this is one, I just love this.
So I says to him,
it's a phrase that both makes my eye twitch, but also is like comforting in a way, because I knew so many people that said that growing up. Like I said, and it just, I love it when I hear it in a movie. It's so good.
And it's also, it fits Lauren as the scenery chewing guy who enjoys being in this movie. I feel like all Coen movies have one character. It's like the John Goodman role or whatever. That's the one guy that's like, this is where I thrive. Like, this is my heaven. Like this.
Yes.
But, lost my train of thought, but he's the one that's enjoying all of it, and he knows what his character is, and he's just having fun with it. And just like when he meets with Marty, it's like, you paid me to do a thing, and now you're not prepared to deal with the evidence of what you paid me to do. Just when he's first just taking the pictures, but then I realize it sets it up so he has the photography for later that he can doctor. If he didn't have that in the first scene, it would kind of just be a weird, hey, now I have photos. But having it earlier on adds to the believability later when it's brought back.
So. Absolutely. And the last couple of clips I got were, we talked about them earlier. It's from that scene with Ray and Marty where they're out back, and you know, Marty's out back stewing, watching these guys throwing stuff into the incinerator, just angry. And Ray shows up.
I thought more was going to happen with that incinerator. Like, kind of was just the red herring.
But it was. You know what? The Coens are good at that. Like, they're good at subverting the expectation of sort of, it was Chekhov's incinerator, right? Like, they showed the incinerator.
Yeah.
They even mentioned it later. Like, after that scene, he mentions it to Lauren as a way to get rid of the bodies.
Yeah.
But we never.
And Ray does throw his rags in there, but he's still got stuff all over the backseat of his car. So it's like,
right.
A for effort, I guess. I don't know.
He would have had to throw his whole car in there. But in that scene, you got this, which, again, this was just a great line. And there's an intensity to this.
I don't particularly want to talk to you.
And it's like, that's worse than him blowing up at him. You're right. You mentioned it earlier, like the big muscly guy getting quiet.
Doing everything I can to hold back the dam. Like, if I take this finger out, it's all going down. None of us want that to happen.
And then finally, the last one I got was this one.
Come on this property again, I'll be forced to shoot you. Fair notice.
Just fair notice.
Yeah.
He warned him.
And again, him declaring, this is what I'm prepared to do. But like, if it came down to it, I don't know that if Ray forced himself onto the property and Marty was there, like, would Marty actually shoot at Ray? I don't know. Given everything that we've seen, I don't see that either of them is like really prepared to get to. I guess that's where this whole thing is. Like, a lot of us are close to that line of like, we could do that thing, give into that impulse, but like, we know we really never will do that. Like, we won't pull the fire alarm when we walk by it, you know?
Right.
But this shows how combination of elements can just get a person to the point where it seems like that is the thing to do.
Yeah.
And I really don't know that any of these bad people are actually fully committed to what they think they want to do.
No, it's an interesting. So here's my question for you. After having watched this now, based on the movies from Ethan and Joel Coen that you have seen, would you put this in the upper tier of it, or would you kind of agree with them where like, it's not as good as some of the other stuff, but you know, like where kind of, how would you not necessarily rank it, but well, yeah, actually rank it. Like, where does it fit? Does it fit in the upper tier, kind of lower tier, mid tier? What do you think?
I think it's like, okay, so I'm speaking specifically about the Coens, but in a larger scale, I feel like any director, like if you have your top five movies of theirs, those are like rock solid, indisputable. Like you can defend these in court. And then like you get like your soft five leading to like your top 10. I would put this below a five, but above a 10. Mm-hmm. It's definitely in that top 10 of their movies because there's so much in it and it's very effective for what it is. It is a much simpler mechanism and piece of machinery that they've put together, but it's shot and written and acted very well. So it stands out above the pieces. The sum is greater than the parts.
Sure. Okay.
But it's, I mean, Raising Arizona is just a fun ride of a movie. And I think it, I guess this is the thing, they very effectively maintain the tone of this movie. And in their other movies, they can more confidently dip into a darker tone and then back out to a more comedic tone and like weave those narratives within. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of just like an A to B. We're just going to keep it in this zone. And they effectively did that.
Yeah.
So it does. It's not just like Memento is not on par with Oppenheimer, but it's also like Memento was pretty significant when it was made, and we wouldn't have this without that.
Sure.
So I feel like most directors' early films can comfortably live in like a 6 to 10 list of a top 10, probably, without people like giving too much flack to it. But
yeah.
I'd say for me, I think when I put it on Letterboxd, I think I gave it like a 4-star because I'm like, I think I enjoyed it, but it definitely, there were issues, but yeah, I'd watch it again. I went and bought it after I streamed it. So
sure.
Yeah.
Well, and I'm with you on that. I don't think it's their best work, but it is really good. And as a debut effort for a feature film that they, you know, they had to go, scrounge up the money for it. At one point, I think they were kind of they cut a little mini trailer with like Bruce Campbell, to show to people to be like, this is the movie we want to do. Do you want to invest some money? And you know, they get the money together, tiny little budget, all the passion involved in that, and you can feel it throughout the movie. It's such a great start, and what it did was this movie crawled so that things like No Country for Old Men and Miller's Crossing and all that could run. Like, it was the foundation for it. And they took what they were able to do here and learn here and be able to distill it down and build upon it. But because of that, those other things couldn't exist unless this had first. And so there's that part of it that I really appreciate. And you can see, I love seeing a director and writer's early work, and you immediately know, like, these are some people to watch out for. It's like catching that, you know, that first time you're just like, wow, you know, somebody just knew what they were doing and how much they wanted to do it right away. Because that doesn't always work. Some, especially actors, I feel like, have to kind of find their legs. Some directors do have to find what they're capable of. And here was just, you know, really, really starting off so well. And it just went up. I mean, their next movie is Raising Arizona, which is in my top three of like favorites of theirs. Like,
oh yeah, yeah. I think it's better than Lebowski. Lebowski, I think, is like the trendy favorite, but it's a fine movie. I think it has diminishing returns the more you watch it. But Raising Arizona is just like great.
There's just Raising Arizona, I find new things I like about it every time I see it. But I also do with Lebowski. Yeah. So, you know, that's me. And then, like, I got to put Oh Brother, Where Art Thou up there because, damn, like, that movie is just amazing.
Yeah.
You know, and
I feel like, so, like, when you asking me about Blood Simple, I feel like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, like, unless you were, like, a super scrutinizing Coen fan, I feel like anybody would kind of give you a pass for putting Oh Brother in your top 10 anywhere in that.
Sure.
Maybe if you said it was their best movie, then someone would be like, well, have you seen, but like, it kind of like with this, if you put it in your top five, there probably would be an asterisk of like, why? But like I said, comfortably like the bottom five of the 10, like, nobody's going to like question that.
You know, and we're saying all this without even having mentioned like Fargo yet.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean,
well,
it's just, can,
go ahead.
Well, it's just when you can have a filmography that has movies like Fargo and No Country for Old Men. And, you know, those are movies that are like up for best pictures. And mm-hmm. we've not really, like, I mentioned No Country for Old Men once. We didn't mention Fargo yet. And we're talking about Lebowski and Oh Brother and Raising Arizona. And we've mentioned Miller's Crossing. Yeah. And, like, they've
Barton
just.
Fink.
Yeah. There's so much they've done.
So many.
And they're able to balance, like, humor with this darkness and sort of realism and grittiness really well.
Yeah.
And they can swing in either direction really well too. Like, it's one thing to have a little bit of both, but they can go darker with something like this, or like No Country for Old Men is very serious, or True Grit is very serious, but then they can have something silly like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, or, you know, Hail Caesar, whatever it is. And yeah. they do both so well. And I think that's what's really impressive.
Well, I think, because when you were talking about like them making this and like the trailer and stuff, and so like going into that, realizing it's not that they are new directors and writers who are working with well-established previously existing actors and costume and ward, like everybody on this was fairly new and fresh with the, I mean, I think Dan Hedaya obviously had some more acting chops, and M. Emmett Walsh probably had been in things before this obviously too, mm-hmm. but a lot of the people in it were newer. And, but you're mentioning that Raising Arizona was just after this. I'm just like, my brain's thinking, if they led with that and then brought this out, I don't think their career trajectory and reception would have been as well received. Whereas like making this and like, we can do this, and then following it with that, we can also do that. And
yep.
now you kind of just have this range where the pendulum swings between the two. And it's like, as long as we stay in these ranges, we can mix them together as we need to. And
yeah,
it would be harder to follow up Raising Arizona with this.
Oh, absolutely. absolutely. It's much easier to go lighter and inject yeah. humor than it is to go in the other direction. I mean, ask any comedic actor who's tried to go into quote unquote serious acting, like,
yeah,
it's really difficult to do in that direction. So they were wise to do it this way. Look, I'm glad I finally got to see this. I get to tick it off my list of like Coen Brothers movies.
Yeah.
And it's super good. It was a great suggestion. And it's one that I will watch again too. Like this will go into not necessarily a regular rotation, but it's something that I'll revisit every so often, because I do think it's such a well-crafted early film. And I do like to go back yeah. and just check out like early stuff from people.
And it's short enough that you can mm-hmm. like, oh, I can just knock this out in an afternoon. And then, yeah.
Yep, exactly. exactly. Yeah. Well, dude, this was awesome. As always, it's fun to have you on, and it's fun to talk about this stuff. And you bring, you always bring good stuff. I mean, 3 days of the Condor, and now this, like, you're always bringing good stuff. Are you working on anything right now? I know last time we talked, you had some irons in the fire, and... You know, what's going on with any of that?
Nothing to actually like speak of at the moment. I've had some loose ideas of things. One thing, I was going to work on a video series about a TV show, and then I rewatched the entire show, and by the end of it, I was kind of like rethinking how I was going to approach it. So that may or may not actually happen. It's also a property that Disney technically owns, so actually putting videos out about that may not really work. I don't have a ton that's actually going on right now, but I've been discovering more movies. Like I mentioned, watching this, I got it conflated with Shallow Grave, which I had not seen, which I've seen now, Danny Boyle's first movie.
Okay.
And in a weird sense, I could see how they kind of pair with each other. So I would recommend checking Shallow Grave out if you haven't seen it. But just what I enjoy is that I can go out and I can hear about or find a movie and something that I haven't even heard of, wasn't even on my radar. And then I can somewhat confidently just ask you, hey, have you ever seen this? Kind of like how all this started. And then like give it a couple of weeks and it's like, now we're talking about it. And it's like, oh, yeah. Like I've got so many people in my life that I can tell them about a movie and I know they're never going to watch it or they're not going to get it the mm-hmm. level that I got or whatever. But yeah, when these... It's not like I've got a bunch of movies that, oh, when it comes to mind, I will think. It's kind of just as things come to my radar, I will pass them along. And
yeah,
I like that we can discuss them as needed here. So
excellent. Yes.
Yeah, I think I told you off. I think I told you off podcast that, or maybe it was on the last one that I'm like, I don't have like tentative plans, but like trying to be on here a little bit more frequently, you know, every couple of months or, you know, more than just once or twice a year.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, as long as I find more things, I'll bring them out to you.
And also you've started using Letterboxd.
Yeah. I wanted to start tracking the movies I'm watching. Also, I picked up a Criterion collection, Ingmar Bergman Cinema. It's like this huge box set of 39 Bergman movies.
Oh wow.
And I was gonna just like watch one a week and spread it out over time. I've kind of been delaying that, but I figured, okay, I'm gonna get on Letterboxd and put my actual like reviews on here and try to catalog the things as I'm watching them. But yeah, I'm on there as I think Juche82. So yeah, I guess see if I'm keeping up with my Ingmar Bergman collection I spent money on but haven't watched yet.
Perfect. No, that's great. Juche82 on Letterboxd, check that out. If you like this show, I do stream live at 8 p.m. Eastern time on Sundays, twitch.tv/TVsTravis, and potentially on YouTube as well in a live stream. So if you like that, check those out. You can always go to TVsTravis.com. to find links for this show, for other shows that I do. I've got information on projects is going to go up there, as well as links for merchandise and the Patreon. Patreon.com/WYHS will help you support this show if you want to do that. And patron backers of the show will get first. You get the show a couple days early, and you also will get the first crack at any new projects that I'm working on. So if you want to do that, check that out. I've got some fun stuff coming up in a few weeks, including I will be doing the show live from Las Vegas at the Viva TMS Vegas meetup. So that's going to be a lot of fun. So keep an eye out for that because I can't wait. I can't wait for that. We're going to be talking about Labyrinth at that point with my guests Shane and Joe, neither of whom had seen the movie.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, which blew my mind. We talked about it was a thing we mentioned when I was in Vegas last year with this group, and we got talking about that. And then like a month or so ago, a couple months ago, we started like, hey, remember when we talked about that and get the ball rolling? And now we're doing it. So, that's happening in a few weeks as well.
Nice.
Next week is TBA. Or TBD. I'm figuring out what is going to happen. So keep an eye on that. But I also have, upcoming, I'm going to go back and watch the old Dolph Lundgren Punisher very soon.
Oh,
so that's going to be an interesting conversation. I can't wait for that. But that's a couple of things coming up in the next few weeks. Keep an eye out. Also, all the social medias is TV's Travis. You can find me there. But Juche, thanks so much for being back on. I love having you on. I mean, it was you and I having a conversation that was the genesis for this show starting. So you are always welcome. We'll do this again soon. We'll find another one. We'll go maybe in a different direction from Coen Brothers next time. But
I was going to soft pitch Shallow Grave, but I don't know. I had to find it online through means that I am not financially supporting. Is how I'll say it.
Okay.
It's not really. I guess there's a DVD, there's a Blu-ray or a DVD that was put out, but yeah, I did watch it. I enjoyed it. It would be an interesting one to pair after this, but that's almost like a secondary side project I've had of like this idea of just watching well-established directors' first movies after having seen like and seeing where they've gone and like, oh, their roots. Because I just feel like first movies of directors always have like a certain like energy to them.
Yeah. That
it's like it hasn't fully formed yet, but it's still like, yeah, a pulse kind of thing.
Yeah, so that could be really interesting. Excellent. Well, as always, a pleasure. And
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for having me. I enjoy being here and always like talking about movies. So
yeah, well, we'll do it again soon. And just remember, everybody, to enjoy your movies and follow Juicer's shirt if you're watching the live stream. Be excellent to each other.
Look, man, I know Marty's a hard-on, but you gotta do something. Say you're sorry, give the money back, get the fuck out of here, or something.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.